You're listening to an audio recording of an event hosted by the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C. On December 15th, KEI hosted an academic paper series event entitled Green Collar Politics, Hurdles in the Clean Tech Race. The speakers were Damian Ma and Will Pearson, both of the Eurasia Group.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today for this 39th edition of the academic paper series presentation. As you know, the KEI director in charge of the academic paper series is my colleague, Nicole Finneman, who is still recovering after ACL reconstructive surgery, soccer injury. Being an ACL surgery survivor myself, I had my surgery just about 5 weeks ago. I know that this is fairly serious business. Anyway, we wish her the best and look forward to her returning to KEI. Here at KEI, I have been following issues pertaining to low carbon green growth in Korea, an issue that came up in full force in the summer of 2008 as President Lee Myung-bak declared that this would be one of Korea's first and foremost priorities. In the coming years, some of you may be familiar with the program we had here on Korea's green carbon low-carbon green growth on June the 24th of this year. One of our most distinguished American speakers is also in the audience today. Today we will be looking at those aspects pertaining to green growth in Korea and elsewhere that elicit attention. Basically, we will be looking at green-collar politics, at the perils of and opportunities presented to South Korea in this global clean tech race. Our two most distinguished speakers will be building and capitalizing on the experience that others have had in this area. I am very pleased to introduce our two most distinguished speakers today. Damian Ma is an analyst in the Asia practice of the Eurasia Group. He focuses in particular on the intersection between Chinese politics and markets, with a particular focus on energy policies, on climate change, commodities, elite politics, industrial policy, U.S.-China trade, and social and internet policies. He is a widely published author. He has written for the Business Week, for Forbes, for Foreign Policy's blog, The Call, and he has also been a commentator in the U.S. and Chinese print media for media outfits, including Time, The Wall Street Journal, CNBC Asia, and BBC America. Prior to joining the Eurasia Group, Damian was a manager of publications at the U.S.-China Business Council in Washington, D.C. He has an M.A. in China Studies from University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, and a B.A. in International Relations and B.S. in Journalism from Boston University. He also earned an Advanced International Student Certificate from People's University in Beijing in 2006. He is fluent in Mandarin Chinese. I am also very pleased to introduce Will Pearson, who is also an analyst in Eurasia Group's Global Energy and Natural Resources Practice. His research focuses on global electricity, on coal, on natural gas markets, on energy efficiency, and on clean energy technologies. Prior to joining the Eurasia Group, Will was a senior analyst in the Powell Market Advisory Group at Pace Global, which is an energy consultancy firm. He holds an MA from University of California, San Diego, from the School of International Relations and Pacific Studies, and a BA in History and Business from James Madison University. That being said, without further ado, I believe, Will, you'll be the one to take the floor first. We look forward to a great program.
Thank you all. Thank you all for coming today and to the KEI for having Damian and myself here. We're just going to go through a few brief slides on our presentation before we open up for Q&A. We really would like to hear your perspectives, what brought you out today. And so we'll kind of give you a little bit of a background as far as how we approach this issue and energy issues in general. As was mentioned, I'm in Eurasia Group's Global Energy and Natural Resources practice. And just to give you a little bit of background on Eurasia Group, and I guess a disclaimer here first, this was a paper that Damien and I did write independently, but a lot of our thinking is shaped by the work that we do for Eurasia Group. So this is a little bit of how at Eurasia Group we do approach this industry. Eurasia Group is a political risk firm. We look at how policies and politics and government actions impact markets worldwide. If you've heard of Eurasia Group, you've probably more heard of our regional and country level analysis. Ian Bremmer, our president, was a Eurasia specialist, and that's kind of how we've made our name. Our global energy natural resources practice is about 4 years old, and that was just where we found that there is a very special relationship oftentimes with both energy and natural resources and government actions. So a lot of what we do is looking at what legislation, regulation, geopolitical trends, technology and technological development, and global trade issues. So that's kind of shaped how we've approached this paper. And again, our focus with this bit of research that we've done is mostly on what we called green collar politics, but it is the very special relationship between clean energy technologies and governments. And how we've tailored the paper that I believe you've gotten today is specifically how various development strategies has an impact on both South Korea and the U.S. And so that's the way that we tried to put together some case studies that we think are very relevant that we'll go through here that we think kind of help provide both, you know, some of the upside, but also some of the risks out there as countries really undertake a very prominent role in developing clean energy industries. So again, I think from our perspective, you know, there is a lot of hype, although this has been somewhat of a challenging year, 2010. There's a lot of hype around the development of clean energy for a lot of good reasons. I mean, for long-term trends and for short-term trends. I think it is important on both environmental reasons, but also just on natural resource availability reasons in the longer term to develop economically viable alternative energy technology. So this could be read in a number of ways, but this paper mostly focused on renewable energy in the power generation sector, but there's clearly also electric vehicles, energy efficiency, and it's the whole range of clean energy technologies. I think there, with good reason, there has been a surge in government interest. Now, one thing that we've noticed is that since 2008, since the financial crisis worldwide, there's been a much greater interest in stimulus programs that have really added to the government support that's really always been there and will continue to be there for quite some time in the clean energy sector. We call this green collar politics because, you know, at times the focus on clean energy technology development has been really more in recent years on job development rather than the many other attributes, positive attributes of clean energy. Energy diversification for energy security purposes, cleaner energy resources, and less dependence on imported energy sources. But really a large focus has been on green-collar job creation, and I think, as we'll discuss in a little bit more detail going forward, you know, that does open up the potential for more trade cases that could disrupt both export markets, but also undermine some political support for renewable energy should that trend continue to take off. Some of the other challenges, you know, have been readily apparent right here in Washington, D.C. Obviously not a lot of progress over the last few years on climate change policy, and that has had a major impact on the lack of progress on a global climate change regime. Now, what this means is without pricing in the environmental externalities associated with traditional energy sources, this places more pressure on government support on the demand side. You know, a lot of talk over the last few years is on kind of the aspiration for grid parity, where renewable energy prices are roughly the same as fossil fuel prices. But things like the shale gas development here in the U.S. and how that's contributed to lower LNG prices worldwide, without pricing in environmental externalities, it's going to take a little bit longer for grid parity, where renewable energy prices meet fossil fuel prices, and that's going to put more pressure on governments to maintain expensive subsidy regimes. And so we go through some of the case studies that kind of are some early examples where government support is showing signs of exhaustion. And there's also that the green collar job creation focus does tie into some trade risks. So with that, I'll kind of launch into a few of the case studies from the major markets that are also involved in the clean energy growth. What we're going to do is really focus on the EU and the US, and then I'm going to hand it over to Damien, who's going to go through the China case study before we go through what we think are some of the most important takeaways before we open up to question and answer. With regard to Europe, clearly the EU was an early mover in the renewable energy space, along with Japan. And it was both on the supply and demand side where you saw a lot of government support. And I would say that South Korea has demonstrated in the last few years an interest in both propping up and industry activity for clean energy, but also demand side incentives to promote the deployment of clean energy technologies. So Europe emerged rather rapidly, both on the member state level, countries like Spain and Germany, but also Denmark and others in Europe, with extensive government support to build out the solar and wind industries specifically, but also introduce mandates. And then that was buttressed by government support from Brussels. So there's both EU-level policy and member state policies that are promoting clean energy uptake in Europe. And this is very significant. I'm now based in London at Eurasia Group's office there, and I've been traveling around to different capitals over the last 6 months, kind of looking for signs, given a lot of the economic problems in Europe that we're focusing on quite closely with the Eurozone crisis and some of the fiscal problems, looking for signs of backsliding with regard to renewable energy support or climate change policies. But really, apart from some of the examples that I'll cite, the policies themselves are still set in stone. And I think that's a very important signal to investors, but also it plays a big role in policy planning in Europe. However, that doesn't mean that there aren't risks ahead. And I think what we've seen in Germany and Spain is that this focus on one of the big pillars of PV solar, which I do view as a very promising technology in the longer term. I think it's an exciting technology. Some of the specific technologies that we've seen developed, by companies like Dow for rooftop shingles, companies that are working on coatings where you can put solar on the outside of buildings to generate electricity just on any building. I think it's a very exciting technology, but it's also very expensive right now. Germany and Spain slashed their solar incentives in 2010. Further cuts could be forthcoming in 2011, really across Europe. And there are many drivers for this. In part, it's lower costs, which is necessary in order to decrease the subsidies needed to promote deployment. But it's also, in Germany specifically, as an example, it was revealed in October that German electricity prices are going to go up 10% next year. And it's not because of increased demand. Obviously, they've got a pretty severe austerity program. So there's not a rising demand. It's not rising prices for fuel. There is a global supply glut for natural gas. So even if prices are higher temporarily during cold spells like this one that we have in DC right now, or that's in Europe right now as well, there's no structural issue for rising electricity prices. It's more because of renewable energy deployment, and specifically with PV solar. So prices are supposed to go up 10% next year on the heels of 9 gigawatts of new solar PV, an estimated 9 gigawatts of solar PV to come online this year. And that's for the first time leading to some public questioning of government support for solar energy in Germany. And quite interestingly there as well, they've had, through years of experience, they've been promoting their domestic solar industry. And this year, with the 9 gigawatts, over 75% of the solar panels that will be installed this year are estimated to be imports, with over 50% of those coming from China. And so it's kind of a double whammy, if you will, of both rising prices but also declining competitiveness of German firms. So it's kind of that industrial policy alignment is not so much in play. And so I think that's contributing to the declining government support for solar PV in Germany's policymaking circles. And their new energy plan for the coming years has much greater, this is part of their compromise to extend nuclear reactor lifetimes. They now want to be at 80% renewables by, I think it's 2050. Most of that is going to be from wind. The actual projected share for solar PV is expected to decline now because of the cost implications. Now, I think that's an important case study because you're seeing the costs, which will at the end of the day be borne by customers. You're seeing governments like Germany and Spain, which have traditionally been the leaders, showing this willingness to cut back on support. Now, again, back to the first point, we haven't seen any decline in overall government support for renewables, but specific technologies might be targeted. And as that would impact a country like South Korea, that might be more of an export-based country for something like solar PV panels, there's the potential that export markets could dwindle in coming years, especially due to ongoing economic issues there. Switching tracks to the U.S., clearly a lot of people here in D.C. see kind of the somewhat disjointed way that the U.S. approaches energy policy. There's no clear strategy compared to many other countries that we look at. With regard to renewable energy, it's kind of a dual system where you have very significant federal financing mechanisms that are very important for actually building projects, but the mandates generally come from the state level. And so really when you look at deployment in the U.S., you have to look at which states have the strongest state-level renewable portfolio standards, places like Texas and California, and that's where the real growth has been. So there's two issues that you have to follow in the U.S., both on the financing level from the federal government, but then also the states. What's interesting with the financing is that, you know, this past year, particularly from Senator Schumer, who toyed with the idea of a Buy American component to a stimulus package program, the 1603 grant in lieu of tax credit program that was extended or is expected to be extended for another 2 years. You see some signs of protectionism. Now, it is mostly aimed at China, which is a hot-button issue. But, you know, it is one of these issues. The United Steelworkers case, which made some headlines late last year, really took on China in any number of ways for their support of renewable energy. And what's interesting there is that a lot of the criticisms included in that case are mirrored in the United States with how the United States government supports its renewable energy industry. So when we look at these protectionist impulses, the necessity for government support, but then the potential trend that we're monitoring very closely to see if there will be more trade cases, maybe starting just between two countries, but potentially involving many more countries because of the very active government support in the industry. That's another kind of worrying trend, I think, in renewable energy, where some of this government support that is needed could also lead to exposure to trade cases and kind of another contributing factor to potential political exhaustion as far as support for renewable energy. With that, I will hand it over to Damian, who will move on to Asia.
Thank you, Will. Sorry about the little switcheroo here, but now that Will's covered the OECD markets, I'm going to talk briefly about the Asian challenge, primarily China. I'll touch a little bit on South Korea, but I know we also have a South Korean expert on its green growth path. I think the couple key points to make on China is obviously it's clear that China has one of the greatest potential clean energy markets in the world, on par with the United States. But I would argue that we shouldn't exaggerate sort of Chinese competition and a Chinese challenge to two markets like U.S., Japan, or even South Korea, and in particular the European markets. I think the Chinese policies right now are primarily supply side. about manufacturing, about jobs, about high-value added manufacturing in particular. And it's and in fact, there has not been as much demand-side support on the in sort of green in green tech in China, and that's primarily due to you know, one factor is that the Chinese are generally still a relatively poor country, and they have a very price-sensitive public that just doesn't, that can't really tolerate the high prices that's associated with renewables. And second is that, you know, simply the Chinese emphasis on jobs and making sure that the millions and millions of people are you know, employed and there's no social instability, they really want to promote an industry, a supply side industry. So a lot of the subsidies and a lot of the sort of help that you see covered in the mainstream media, it's primarily about state subsidies on the supply side. On the that's problematic. Why? Because in the solar sector, you have 95% exports, that's clearly not sustainable, as Will mentioned, and as I will talk about more at length. You get into trade problems with your trading partners because you're exporting. You've been able to integrate a supply chain that's and you've been able to lower costs of these manufacturing high value added you know, solar PVs and so on. You're bound to expose your industry to a higher level of export risk, and that's potentially a problem. But the Chinese government still is not willing to really come out with a demand side incentive for solar yet. And partially it's because they are taking lessons from Germany and so on, that, you know, if you set it too high, there's not a very clear way to set it, what's the right price, and if you set it too low, nobody wants to do it. If you set it too high, then you end up not being able, you know, to afford it, and the government doesn't necessarily want to subsidize it. And I think the other thing that's often missed, and that's something that Will also mentioned, is that, you know, the Chinese government is pushing not just renewables, but they're also pushing, you know, the broad idea of clean energy. So that includes more than just solar and wind. That includes nuclear. That includes natural gas, also unconventional gas. And because of you know, the supply glut and cheaper gas, and, you know, the Chinese have very, very ambitious targets for their gas on growth too over the next 12-5 year plan. So that's another area of competition that's going to perhaps possibly undermine the priority, for renewables. That said, you know, they still have clearly big growth targets for solar and wind. That is primarily because they have a 15% target by 2020, where they want non-fossil fuels to make up, basically, they want to diversify away from coal and have renewables, well, actually, non-fossil fuels make up 15% of their energy mix. So that binding target domestically does promote the continued growth in the renewable sector. But the growth has to be a lot more balanced on the demand side, or else they're going to face, I think, risks going forward. So just really quickly on South Korea, I think obviously South Korea has been kind of a latecomer to the clean tech race. And they basically, you know, started really focusing on demand and supply side policies in 2008 with the Green New Deal. Obviously one instructive lesson from the Chinese side is if you promote the export model very substantially, and there is some evidence now that the Korea may want to do that by sort of I think the target is reaching 10 to 15% of global market share by 2020 or 2030, basically you are going to be competing with the Chinese. I mean, there's really no other way around it because the Chinese have the same strategy, and so you are going to get these competitive dynamics. And if the Chinese is highly exposed to export risks, then that is a lesson that I think the Koreans would have to consider as well going forward. And going back to why this is a really huge risk in terms of trade. I want to talk more specifically about the United Steelworkers case. Basically, there are three scenarios that we foresee going from the least severe to basically the worst case on scenario. The first is what we would like to call a flash in the pan, which essentially means that this was purely pre-election politics, that it was a labor union trying to go after China during the election sort of fear-mongering type of politics, and that right afterwards it basically fizzles out and nothing ever happens. And the key signpost here is that, you know, Chinese President Hu Jintao is coming in the third week of January for his first official state visit. And the USTR is supposed to make a decision on the case right around the same time. So potentially you might not want to embarrass the Chinese president while he's in town. So potentially this basically just goes away and there's no more risk. The other two is that basically the USTR says, okay, this is a good case. We are not going to go after China on every single case. You know, keep in mind the case is 5,800 pages. So it's got everything. It goes after China on everything. And so they may pick up certain parts that are WTO compliant or that they actually have a case, and this becomes protracted in a very long, drawn-out battle at the WTO. And I think the worst-case scenario is that once this case does get picked up, other markets like the EU or Japan, Canada, and other countries who have similar policies start going after each other. And you really get wrapped up in a much more escalated global war on clean energy, a global trade war on clean energy, and that obviously sets back the sector's growth, and of course could potentially raise the cost of clean energy quite substantially. So right now it's obviously not clear exactly which way this is going to be, but I think it is certainly worth tracking this particular case, because I think the ramifications could be far and wide if it does go forward. And I think Will has covered basically the second point here about the incentives on scheme. So I just quickly go over the last point, which is that I think many policies you have to make sure that you don't that they want to basically prevent overcapacity and overheating in these sectors. One case I'd like to talk about is actually the Chinese wind sector. They've grown at basically 100%. Installed capacity growth for the last 2 or 3 years. And they were supposed to only have a 10 gigawatt installed capacity in 2010, and they're already at 25. So they're 150% over their target. They're going like crazy. And the problem is that they're sprinting ahead of on demand, and the Chinese grid system just simply cannot catch up. The number that's thrown about is you got about one-third of wind capacity just idling. It's not connected to the grid. It's not generating any power. And so that's a potential problem on the demand side, too, is that you're going too fast for the sake of manufacturing jobs, but you're actually not producing clean energy in a meaningful sense. So I think that's one thing, that is certainly one thing to also caution against. And finally, there are other people looking for a so-called reverse auction system, which has been tested in Brazil, and which is basically you allow project managers to sort of come up with a cost for long-term on investment, and then you sort of design demand side incentives based on that cost, rather than just arbitrarily setting a feed-in tariff incentives that nobody really knows exactly how high or low that it should go. And I just want to conclude with what we think are some broad key takeaways. The key point here is there is clearly not a silver bullet in designing the right set of policies to spur green tech growth. As you can see, from Europe to China to Japan and South Korea, there are a host of different policies that one should use. And I think the key is to hedge against the risks we've outlined, but also remain fairly nimble in policy and not be totally set in stone right away on how to proceed. One key thing that we found over the case studies is that you don't, in a time of global economic and financial downturn, you don't want to overly set an aggressive on demand side incentive, because that becomes a fiscal liability further down the line. States can't afford it. Should there be another contraction, another double dip, public support and political support could wane. The number two takeaway is that we also believe that seeing clean tech growth strictly through the prism of jobs, that of course that facilitates the erecting of trade barriers, non-tariff barriers, and you could potentially wrap the entire sector in trade spats. I think the better way to look at it is to focus on deployment, technology, R&D, to lower costs, to do commercial on deployment, and that would naturally create jobs and lower costs. And the third takeaway is, there's a lot of sort of, I guess I would call, if you read any Tom Friedman, piece, it's about how the Chinese are, doing great. And there's this huge emphasis on authoritarian model and envy. I don't think that's the best model either. They have limited innovation capacity. It's primarily supply-side manufacturing. They're not doing cutting-edge technology. They're digesting what's here right now and making it cheaper. But the American model right now also clearly lacks in a national-level strategic policy. You have a very fairly meek government. There's no climate change policy. And most of the things are happening on the state level. But we have a lot of innovative capacity, and we still have a lot of finance and capital. So I think a possible melding of the two models, where you have a national strategic plan that leverages a U.S. on advantages, but also that plan is sort of unimmune to sort of political risk in the United States. I think that's potentially an attractive combination for the short term. And finally, I think we need to make sure that you can't just focus strictly on economic growth or strictly on providing domestic on demand for renewables, because you really need to have a really healthy balance on between the two, because one thing is that you have to focus on a longer term strategic goals and while trying to create, you know, jobs and industry. But two, you really got to focus on, if you're serious about promoting the industry, you got to focus on sort of lowering costs and increasing on domestic demand to introduce these energies into your energy mix. And I will just conclude there. I think we will be taking questions after this. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Will and Damian, for a very informative presentation. Ever since Korea's New Green Deal was brought to our attention in the summer of 2008, we have followed developments pertaining to Korea's low-carbon green growth very closely, and in light of publications and events that we have also had here at KEI, we have learned that experts elsewhere do commend Korea for this vision of low carbon and green growth, for acknowledging that yes, this green business is green growth, and also taking into consideration that the specific conditions of Korea, a country that is not exactly endowed with natural resources, a country the size of Virginia, with a population six times the size of Virginia, it makes perfect sense to focus on this low-carbon, green-growth approach from an environmental perspective, also from an economic perspective, and a national security perspective, if not to reduce, but at least to balance reliance on fossil fuels, imported fossil fuels. That being said, while this focus on clean energy, including renewable energy in Korea, is most commendable, today we have learned a very valuable lesson that Korea does need to pay attention to some of the hazards facing this green drive. Excessive focus on green collar job creation can basically create the potential for trade issues. Also, government support may have an impact on electricity prices, domestic electricity prices. And ultimately, if Korea stays focused on enhancing its green technology exports, eventually it will become clear that it's competing clearly against China. That being said, we would like to now open our discussion to questions from the audience, and our two speakers will be more than happy to answer your questions. Please remember to identify yourselves and the organization. I'll go to Mike first and then Mark.
It's clear from your presentations that you view nuclear power as in competition with clean energy or with renewables. That's clearly not the case in China and Korea. In both cases, their view is more the green energy is, it's sort of a grab bag, but their emphasis is by far and away on nuclear power, as that's what China's referring to when they talk about 15% Korea, as you know, is in the forefront of not only building nuclear, but exporting it on a grand scale with plans for 50 nuclear plants. At the event that Greg mentioned here earlier, several of the leading Korean green energy people who came over and spoke in response to this issue rather cleverly made the point that whether climate change exists or doesn't exist, it doesn't really concern them. They know that we need nuclear power for many other reasons than carbon issues, and that that's they're going to pursue it, and if you need to use the green label, that's okay, fine. So I must assume that you guys don't look at the nuclear issue very much, but I'd like to know what you think about that. The rest of your presentation was rather pessimistic, you know, because it's becoming more and more clear that wind and solar and so forth are an extremely expensive way to produce relatively small amounts of energy, and compared to nuclear, it's something of a waste, and it's becoming known. That's why it's declining. But your presentation sort of captured that pessimism, so I'd like to know how you answered that.
We focus quite a bit on nuclear as well, because we also look at nuclear absent carbon prices or other emissions externality prices priced into the markets. We also look at it as an industry that is very much dependent right now on government support. And I think you've seen that play out in markets worldwide, that it has been where governments take a more active role. It was true in the U.S. In the 60s and 70s and 80s. It's true right now in China and South Korea, that you do need government support to build out nuclear energy, just given the high capital costs. And so I think that's another area that we do follow quite closely. We didn't focus on nuclear quite as much here, although with South Korea, I think we touch on this in the paper. That's clearly emerged in the last few years as a new industry where South Korea is very competitive. And we do work with a number of clients based in Japan. And you know, that kind of the UAE deal this past year kind of really marked a real changing point in the nuclear industry, where South Korea is now very competitive internationally. And the traditional nuclear suppliers have taken note. I do think, you know, at least in the U.S., when you think about, you know, the competition between nuclear and renewables, I mean, they are somewhat different in how they currently would be utilized in the power sector, where nuclear does have a better capability of really displacing, I would say, primarily coal power as baseload power generation, something you can really depend on. Lacks the intermittency that is right now associated with wind and solar. So, I mean, there are clear differences, and there's room for both. But because they're both dependent on government support, I would say, and government finances, in the U.S., when there's talk of really, I would say that the renewable energy standard that was proposed during the last Congress, I would say that's done. You might see a clean energy standard that would include nuclear support as well. And the renewable energy industry is somewhat fearful of that, I would say, in that they look at this as they are competing for a limited amount of government support, financing support for financing and building these plants. And I think that if you do have clear government support, that nuclear might be a better case right now. So I do think that there is some competition. Both are dependent on government support. And even though there is room for both, I think there's not really financial support for significant build out outside of places like China, where you right now have a lot more financing availability than you do in some other markets. So, I mean, I don't know. I'm not sure if that entirely addressed your question, but we certainly do look at nuclear, and especially from the export perspective, I think that's a very interesting market to watch, where government support is playing a much more prominent role in who's getting contracts where. I would say it's still capital. Yeah, it's still capital.
Nuclear also produces far cheaper energy, but it has a high capital.
There's no marginal cost per
renewable.
It's high capital,
much. Before I lose control, I'll go to Mark, please.
Thank you. Mark Mannion from the Congressional Research Service. I'm wondering, you know, turning back to South Korea and the green growth policies, I'm wondering if you could talk about a little bit more detail about what that entails. And specifically, what I'm particularly interested in is to what extent you feel that some of these policies are would be WTO compliant. You know, I see a lot of talk about, regulation and standard setting, mandates, but I'm particularly interested in some of the subsidies, which you're talking about, you know, several tens of billions of dollars, at least that's my understanding. To what extent would these be vulnerable to WTO cases? To what extent would foreign firms be eligible to apply for them? Are there any domestic content requirements that are attached to them, as there are in apparently in many of the Chinese cases?
I can say, disclaimer, we are not trade lawyers. We've consulted with them, especially in the aftermath of the USW case. But we are not trade lawyers, and the WTO component is rather challenging, and I think that's going to be something to watch if the USW case goes forward. I would say that in looking at the USW case, I think that there's more weight to the charges that have to do with the supply side, the manufacturing enhancement and manufacturing subsidies and incentives. And with South Korea, and again, I think there's probably some people in this room that are better experts on South Korea's green energy policies, so if you want to chime in at any point, please do. There is this acknowledgement that they're promoting both the supply and demand side. So there's there are industrial support to build out PV, solar photovoltaics, offshore wind sector. And again, I haven't looked into enough detail about the exact mechanisms, but when you start seeing pure clean government support to build out these industries, that can be viewed as anti-competitive. Domestic industries as opposed to competitors. So there's some room there. I would think on the demand side, I would say that's largely outside of the realm. I don't care as much about WTO law. But that's kind of my quick take. I don't know if you have anything to add on that.
Right. Most certainly in South Korea's case, this, of course, has a lot to do with the fact that these are perceived as immediate priorities. In very general terms, this is a country that has gone through several decades of intensive, accelerated economic growth and industrialization at the expense of the environment. So there's generally widespread agreement that this is a positive direction to take. Then, of course, there is the concern for the creation of opportunities in the green economy that, as you pointed out, may create some misperceptions in terms of the trade implications, some actual hazard. Of course, the key is certainly providing equal and fair access to foreign outside players in this area. And of course, some of these aspects are already covered in the existing legislation that is already in place in Korea, the Green Growth Bill that has been passed, that was passed by the Korean National Assembly about a year ago. And Korea has been commended for having a legal framework in place dealing with green legislation. Of course, we have also been following with great interest Korea's role as one of the, let's say, two hubs together with India, spurring a network of bilateral free trade agreements throughout Asia. We have been following with great interest developments pertaining to the CORUS FTA. And the very fact that Korea has been a driver and a promoter of free trade in Northeast Asia and beyond would basically encourage one to be very optimistic regarding the implications that this green growth drive will have for trade as well.
And can I'll add one more point. And I would be happy after this to to exchange in contact information because I could put you in contact with the trade lawyers that we've talked with. And I think one other point that that's been made to us is that I don't want to look at WTO law as something that's static. And so I think that with green energy, there is this potential that, you know, there is, in some ways, considering the high cost of renewables, if you are going to promote the industry, there's something to be said for kind of ensuring that, there's some job creation. And I think that's what we've seen, as China's kind of slowly been taking over solar export markets, governments are just less willing to support just a purely import-driven market for renewables, since it's already adding to cost of electricity, then you're also adding to import dependency there. So there's a potential that WTO law could be changed in some way that would allow governments to prop up these, or nurture, as we say, these kind of growing or strategic type industries. But I'd be happy to pass on soon.
And let me just add one more point on the local content requirement point. I mean, China actually got rid of it in 2009, probably. They never had
trade,
right. I mean, they never had one on solar, but they got rid of it. So, that point was brought up in the USW case. So I suspect that's not going to hold that much legal water at this point. But they got rid of it only after they've achieved 85% market share in domestic wind turbines, right? And the original intention they've had it for, I think at least a decade, and it was to strengthen a domestic supply chain. So to the extent that the South Koreans don't need to do that, in other words, they already have a fairly robust domestic supply chain, then they necessarily don't need to do what the Chinese did, right? Because the Chinese were just not happy to import any parts that they needed for the wind. They wanted to build it themselves. Koreans already have that, then there's no need for that. So that issue could potentially not be as volatile.
Please.
Hello, hi. My name is Kevin Kim from the U.S. Korea Institute. I actually have two questions. One, in the Europe section, in the paper, it mentions that that the EU's mandate of 20% energy supply must come from renewable sources by 2020, and there's that larger political framework that sort of led to Spain and Germany participating in this renewable growth. My first question is, what about the rest of Europe? Where is their movement on this sector? And the other is sort of relating to what Greg talked about, a sort of greater regional cooperation, whether it comes from trade or CORIS, that's to be seen. But is there a larger Northeast Asian regional framework that deals with renewable energy? And if there isn't, do you guys foresee something like this happening in the near future?
With EU policy, it's there's different trajectories. Now there's also different targets. So the deployment target is there. It comes to 20% for all of the EU, but it's different targets for different countries based on where they were. I think in 2005. So different countries really have taken different strategies and are at different places as far as meeting these targets. Germany, some of these other countries that have really taken a lead, Denmark, in really promoting their industry from the beginning, are on their way to meeting the 2020 targets. Other countries, the UK, for instance, they're really struggling. They're still around 2 or 3% renewable energy, and their focus right now is on pretty expensive offshore wind technology. And so, when I think of, are these countries, is the EU going to meet the 2020 target? I mentioned what I think is important, that the policies that are in place are shaping decisions being made by governments and financing mechanisms for different types of technologies. It doesn't mean I think they're going to meet their 2020 target. I actually don't think a lot of the countries are going to meet their 2020 target, especially countries like the UK. It is going to be a cost issue. If you're looking at offshore wind, there is room there for the cost to come down. It's going to be interesting now that South Korea is entering into the market, Germany's in the market, the UK is focusing on offshore wind, U.S. showing some signs in some states, but there needs to be a big cost correction or a cost decline in offshore wind in countries that our democracies. You could see a very popular revolt against the cost increases associated with specific types of technology. And so I think it's looking at what the renewable resource is available to a country, and also just the economic standing, the broader economic issues. And so I think in Europe, it's a really hard call to look at where European renewable energy support is going to be in, say, 5 years, because there's also the broader economic question. You know, with economic recovery, you could see greater appetite to take on higher electricity prices associated with renewables, ongoing economic struggles, higher costs at a time when really demand isn't increasing, really could tax popular and therefore political support. So that's a big question mark. So I hope that helps. We can talk about other specific countries if you like after. Right. Northeast Asia.
I would say that a regional architecture, specifically in clean energy, would be quite challenging in the current environment. I think you would have to get obviously buy-in from the Chinese, and I suspect the Chinese are not that willing to do so at this point. In part, you have obviously the rare earth issue with the Japanese. That's going to be problematic, and I don't see the Chinese reversing course on that specifically in terms of the port system. And so I think if you have something like that, you would have to obviously get the Chinese to agree that they'll continue to be supply ample things to Japan, and I don't sense that the Chinese are really going to go back on that. I think the fundamental problem is domestic politics right now is viewing this huge push for innovation in China, and I think to the extent that kind of political trend and that kind of view persists, it's going to be extremely hard to get the Chinese to really buy into a regional architecture, because they view it as much more of a competitive angle. So, of course, now there is some inkling that this whole innovation drive is fracturing too at the margin. So if that political emphasis shifts domestically in China, then I think you're going to get more sort of willingness to cooperate and collaborate. But it's going to be, I think, fairly difficult in this environment to really seriously, meaningfully create something like that.
Please. Thanks. Lutz Weischer with the World Resources Institute. I wanted to come back to the risk of renewables fatigue in Europe, because I think you could present a slightly more optimistic scenario as well. I work on international technology policy at WRI, but I also happen to be German, so this is kind of not only from my research, but also things I've observed when I still live there. The public discussion about the high level of support and increasing electricity prices, I wouldn't say is a thing we've seen for the first time this year. We get that every October. These numbers are published every October, and every October you get a little public debate about we are supporting renewables, it makes electricity prices go up. I wouldn't overestimate that, particularly as I think the extremely high growth of PV this year was related to the fact that there was an extraordinary cutback. So it was just a lot of people deciding that before the rates were reduced, they were just going to put up an installation. So I wouldn't expect the same growth rates over the next years. So less of not a 10% price increase every year. I wouldn't overestimate that. More broadly, I think if you look at the German government and its new energy scenarios and the new energy strategy, it's actually it's a very pro-renewables, very convinced of renewables. We have a center-right government in Germany now. It's a Christian Democrat liberal coalition, and so trying to translate that into American terms, that would be like a conservative libertarian coalition that has a more ambitious, more long-term target for renewables than anything the Social Democratic Green government ever dared to do. So I don't see any renewables fatigue. I think if, after a year where your PV panel prices have dropped by 30%, that you adjust your rate by 20%, is just completely reasonable, and it's not a sign of declining public support. I guess it's more a comment than a question, but I'd be interested to hear what you think. I think in Europe the support continues to be strong. And a question I would have, because one of your conclusions was that an amalgamation of sort of the American and the Chinese model could be the promising model for the future. I was wondering what, you know, what about the region that's been most successful in renewables? What about the European model? Or is the European model the amalgamation of the American and the Chinese one?
Good. I'll respond to the comment. And I'll leave the amalgamation to Damien. But I agree with you in that. I think, and I tried to make the point, I think we were kind of underscoring some of the risks that are there. Like I said in the presentation, I have been struck in going to Berlin, to Paris, to Brussels, and Madrid, that there is still support to meeting the existing targets, but also perhaps even more stringent targets. And so I think that is a good point and a fair point. I agree with you there. I would like to say that I think that the reason I think that this year's the 10% increase, there's a number of reasons that I do think that that was significant. I mean, 9 gigawatts of solar PV it's a lot in 1 year. And it wasn't so much me saying that, that there was, this is the first time. It was through meetings with government, various government ministries, Ministry of Economics, Ministry of Environment, some Green Party representatives, talking to people from Greenpeace, this was somewhat of a shock, that, 10% increase on prices when, really you're introducing austerity measures into government. There's the Eurozone crisis. I think that there's a number of reasons why, the timing of this kind of rate shock really isn't too welcome. It's a pretty significant rate increase, 10% at a time when demand really, it's some good signs in Germany, but it's a tough time still economically. So that's what I do think that is somewhat significant. And I guess the point that we're making there, again, is not that there has been any kind of retrenchment or backsliding in overall support. I think it's a sign of backsliding, especially when the technologies that are being pointed to as far as how to meet the targets. Solar PV took a huge cut this year, and I think when you look at the renewed government support, and again, one kind of cynical take perhaps on the renewed government support there, it is from a conservative government, but I think it was also linked to the nuclear reactor lifetime extensions, and so I think that was somewhat of a compromise, a trade-off, where they're going to extend, unless there's a successful court challenge, the lifetimes of these reactors, and I think as a political trade-off, they renewed some of the, or enhanced really, the support for renewables. But yeah, I do think that the support there, the support mechanisms are significant, but looking already at, they did decrease the role of solar as far as meeting that future program, and offshore wind is really now the major technology of choice. And I just think that there's similar cost constraints there that will emerge. Let's say in 5 years, as more offshore wind farms are installed, there's going to be more rate shock. And so I just kind of highlight that, not to say that, there's, again, I agree with you that there's not, there is still support there, but I just think it's an ongoing risk, and especially with kind of a low price outlook, especially for natural gas, I think you're going to see ongoing need for subsidies.
And let me just clarify, I mean, when I say melding two models, I don't mean putting a single party, authoritarian state in mixing it with a vibrant democratic system. What I do mean is, similar to Germany, China does have a national level strategic policy, right? But that's what's lacking in the United States. We don't have one, but we do have a more of a Silicon Valley model where we rely on innovation, VC, and so on to produce these, changes and technological advancements. The Chinese have a national strategy, but it's very state heavy. It's a big lumbering state, it's dominated by state-owned sectors. They're not very innovative, and they don't really allow a very huge role for the private sector participation. So what I meant simply is that to have a sort of a longer-term national strategic plan that's sort of protected against the political winds from either party going forward. It's just purely a national plan, and then you also utilize our inherent advantages in the U.S. the VCs, the financial capital, and so on. So I think that's what I mean by sort of picking the best from both countries and trying to find a near-term combination that could potentially work.
Abe, and then Mark.
Quick question on, Damian, your comment about competition in the future. I mean, in your presentation, you mentioned that Korea and China would probably go head-to-head in the future in terms of clean tech exports. And you didn't mention any other countries. And so I'm wondering if, are you implying from that comment that like places like Japan, EU, and US will not continue to grow in their innovation and in their market shares as well? And so is China the leading threat? Or is it, or were you just kind of limiting, scoping your comments to just Asia in general?
Yeah, I was for the purpose of the presentation, but and China is obviously one of the biggest potential threats. And if you look at, in terms of high value added manufacturing, under which you know clean tech stuff would be counted, you know, China has basically really taken over Japan's market share. Not the United States, not the EU in particular. They're doing okay, but it's primarily Japan. So to the extent that South Korea comes up in a similar fashion, then I think, you know, this, I mean, just looking at what has happened in the last decade or so, it's been Japan down story, China up story, and high value added manufacturing. So so I think that is something that that South Korea needs to be mindful of, because that's what the Chinese have done. So it you know, the Western countries are still okay, but it's really Japan that suffered from Chinese competition.
So are you suggesting that the same markets and same types of technology,
exactly,
Korea and China are going after, and so they're going to be direct competitors,
exactly,
to each other?
And South Korea has a market share target, which is directly going to undermine Chinese market share. And so it just seems competition is very, very likely.
I would also say that it's more just kind of the model for development, in that, and you said South Korea is a you know, somewhat of a, you know, high population, but I would say that a lot of the government support is designed in countries worldwide, but it is a kind of an export model, and there is a demand, there are demand side policies, but it's also, they clearly want to be a bigger player in exports of PV, of EVs, electric vehicles, photovoltaic, solar, and so I think that, you know, there are, that's perhaps what Damian was getting at there, was it's more kind of that export driven model, and Japan might be included in that as well, where they also sporadically have domestic incentives, but you know, it's also very dependent on exports. Where I think you know, Europe and the U.S., it's just very large markets. You know, China's fascinating. You know, I think in just, you know, when you look at China and how big, and how, you know, the graphic that we have that we showed earlier on the it's in the paper on the top 10 PV manufacturers worldwide, and you look at the top 10 in 2005, and there's a firm from Taiwan, but that's it. And then when you look at 5 years later, it's pretty dominated by China. You can just see the rise of China. And it's fascinating because there is no domestic market for solar. So when I look at, you know, kind of this generation of solar PV, you know, China's taken advantage of the big markets that are opened up, but they're also, they've acknowledged that it's a higher cost. Pretty much a much lower efficiency type technology, and so they've been very hesitant. We've been monitoring their efforts to introduce feed-in tariffs and other demand side incentives, but it's higher cost. I mean, Germany, even after the this year's solar PV feed-in tariff cut, it's still about five times the cost of coal power. Now, again, you need, we want to see better pricing and of environmental externalities, but it's a huge price premium. And so, you know, I would think that, you know, right now, as Damian mentioned, China has basically taken what existing PV technologies there were, and they've made them, you know, they're taking advantage of their you know, labor advantages and ability to ramp up manufacturing capacity, so they've made it more cheap. But, one thing that I like to throw out there is, you know, there is this potential that, you know, with the Silicon Valley model and some of the other firms that are looking at kind of future generation, you know, nano solar thin films or thin film coatings for PV, the roofing shingle type technologies, that, you know, the whole market could change once again. And so that's another kind of risk that I think Damian's mentioning, with this very heavy demand government support for exporting of existing technologies without looking at what the future market might be for more efficient, better technologies. There's a risk there.
Great. We will take the next question from Mark and then the lady in the second row.
Hi. This is related to your answer to the last question. Can you talk more about the South Korean industry as it is today? I assume it's conglomerates, the Chaebol, who are producing the turbines and the cells, photovoltaic and other cells that are being used in South Korea. But is that the case? If so, which conglomerates are doing it? Are there any components that South Korea seems to be poised to be able to have an impact? So basically, if you could analyze the Korean industrial structure for the sector, who the players are and what products you expect that Korean companies could have a potential for breaking into this top 10, say, in 5 years or so.
I would actually like to defer to my colleague here, to Greg, and we do have a colleague at Eurasia Group that's done more looking at the specifics of the South Korean sector and the development there. We were more kind of looking at with this paper at what some of the risks might be with the sector. But
certainly, one example that comes to mind as an example of possibly building on the previous experience that Korea's conglomerates have had in other industries would be that of turbines for windmills and tidal power stations. Some of the Korean conglomerates have extensive experience building propellers for large ships. That experience is directly applicable to turbines used for wind and tidal power generation. As far as we know, some of the Korean conglomerates have been quite actively involved in wind and tidal power generation in Canada. There is quite significant interest here as well, and we expect to see some Korean contributions in that area. Certainly, in when it comes to solar power generation, or when it comes to wind power generation, or even tidal, once again, thinking of Korea's size, of course, there are certain limitations inherent to the size of Korea. And that is why the issue of nuclear power generation and its importance as part of a coherent clean energy policy was raised on previous occasions. Nevertheless, most of Korea's green industries present a good potential as export industries as well. Dr. Manning, this also gives me an opportunity to abuse my privileges as moderator and also ask my question. Damien, you have mentioned the United Steelworkers case, and you have also touched upon the issue of rare earth elements. One of the issues raised in the United Steelworkers case is that of China's limiting access to rare earth elements. The Korean government, the Ministry of Knowledge and Economy, actually came up with a report a little bit over a year ago regarding some of these industrial vitamins, minerals essential to green industries as well. The Department of Energy released a report this morning addressing the vulnerability the U.S. vulnerability to rare earth shortages. Our colleagues at CSIS at the Energy and National Security Program, they had an excellent program this morning. Two of them are here in the audience today. Would you have any recommendations for Korea regarding this supply chain risk and the supply chain issues that it might be facing in this new green industries as it prepares to deal with the inherent geopolitical risks?
Right. Well, let's first of all, you know, our view is that we do not believe that the Chinese are actually banning rare earth, or some have referred to it as an embargo. I don't think there is any such policy. I think the policy is primarily a export quota-focused, industrial policy-based policy. And 2 weeks ago, I was actually just in Baotou, Inner Mongolia, where they make about, 70-80% of the world's rare earths. And I had the chance to visit a rare earth high-tech zone. And I came away convinced a lot more that it's basically what I would call a resources for technology gambit. So you can come in here, you can invest in high-tech industries, high-value-added manufacturing, downstream, and you can have more access to rare earths. Now, it's unclear right now that this policy will ultimately work or fail, but I think the thinking behind, again, is one similar to the local content requirement. They want to have a robust domestic supply chain from the raw materials to the end product, and two, they want to be able to acquire technology. And so, I was told pretty specifically that if you're an export company, you're probably not very welcome in these high-tech zones. You would be welcome if you're producing high-value-added downstream products. So I think, at the heart of it is really about technology acquisition, about domestic supply chain. Does it make sense that the Chinese should be importing some of this stuff? Probably, but that's sort of not really where the view is going at this point. So. Again, to the extent that this feeds into broader thinking about industrial policy, this is something that will remain in China. And what the Japanese have done, of course, they've gone around China's periphery with Vietnam, Mongolia, and so on to strike deals on diversification of supply. So, the Chinese promise they'll still supply basically their restricted, levels. They're just not going to, take it off the market completely. But whether that will be sufficient to meet future demand as clean energy takes off across the world, that's obviously a huge problem. And so I think they have essentially kicked themselves in the foot by allowing other people like Australia and the United States in particular to make a case for restarting their mines. So I think the strategy right now is simply diversification of supply away on away from China. But I didn't get the sense it was very nefarious. It wasn't really trying to sort of hurt Japan or any other country in particular, simply about promoting their domestic industry.
Very much. Yes. And
do we?
I apologize. Yes.
Does South Korea have a stockpile policy or program currently or in the near future?
As far as I know, I'm not aware of a stockpile policy per se. No.
Yeah, I've never heard of one either. I mean, it's something that we could look into. It's an interesting question. But
even the Chinese don't have one. They're about to start one, I believe.
Great. Well, that being said, I would like first and foremost to thank our two speakers today for a very informative presentation and discussion. I would also like to take this opportunity to let you know that our next academic paper program will take place on the 2nd of February. It's going to be the 40th edition of the academic paper series. A former UK ambassador to the DPRK, Ambassador John Everard, will be our featured keynote speaker, addressing the markets of Pyongyang, a paper that he will be authoring for KEI under the Academic Paper Series program. That being said, please join me in thanking our two speakers today.